This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Each year, Norwich University gathers writers, military officials, and thinkers together to contemplate various aspects of war and conflict. This year, the theme of the William E. Colby Military Writers Symposium is Going to War, the Cost to Families, Communities, and Nation. And today on the show, we're going to talk about that with two of the presenters at this year's symposium. Carl Marlantis is a former Marine lieutenant who served in the combat infantry in Vietnam. He's the author of two books, a novel about the Vietnam War called Matterhorn, and the nonfiction book What It Is Like to Go to War. John Coffin retired as a colonel from the U.S. Army in 2013. He served as a lieutenant in Southeast Asia from 1968 to 1970, and he served for many years as staff psychologist for the Vermont National Guard, debriefing soldiers as they returned home from deployments. They both joined us in 2013 to talk about their lives and war and military service, and we are so pleased to have them both back today. John and Carl, what a pleasure to talk with you.
Hello, Jane.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I'm curious, since the theme of the symposium is the cost of war, Carl, what was the cost of war to you?
Well, my family. I ended up getting post-traumatic stress, like a whole lot of people, and had never heard of it. We didn't know what hit us. My ex-wife and I are great friends now, and we look back on that time. It's like, if we had just been a little bit more educated, we probably could have weathered the storm. But she just thought I went crazy, and so did I. And so that's a personal cost. The other one is, of course, a lot of sadness because you lose friends. And that's another major cost. And I think those are the two that get me. I keep thinking about, well, and then my tax dollar has gone to places that I didn't want it to go to. So April 15th is coming very soon.
Yeah, that's on the minds of many, I'm sure. John, what about for you?
Well, Jane, I think what I came back from overseas with was a deeply cynical, dark personality that I wasn't aware of. I think it's safe to – it's probably not an exaggeration to say that my total belief system and fantasies of how to be – a citizen and a man and a soldier were obliterated in the face of the many duplicities of the war and as it was implemented and conceived. And over the years, fortunately, I've been able to look at that cynicism and try to rechannel it a little bit.
No, I'll chip in on that. I agree with that. I think one of the major costs of recent wars, starting with Vietnam, is this cynicism. I remember I was in college at the time when the war was going on, and I remember saying to my college friends one late night discussion, "It's well, but an American president wouldn't lie to the American people," and they broke out laughing. And when I tell that story to my kids, they look at me like I'm from some other planet. What do you mean the American president didn't lie to American people? We have changed as a country very seriously toward the cynical side, and that's not healthy. I mean, naivete is not healthy either, but I think we need to get to some sort of center here.
So, Carl, you think it was your generation, the Vietnam generation, that in sort of infused that cynicism into American culture?
I would think it is most likely because we were told things that were blatantly untrue, and a lot of heartache and a lot of dead people, not to mention 2 million Vietnamese. I'm not a pacifist, but I think that, you know, when we go to war, we've got to get very clear on it, and you need to be able to explain it in terms that an 18-year-old understands. And that's, to me, things like, well, if you don't go there, your family's going to die. Okay, I get it. You know, as opposed to, well, we have these dominoes that are falling in Southeast Asia. And then, you know, I mean, like the Gulf of Tonkin, all those things that were fabricated to sort of just get us in there. You get cynical. War is bad enough when there's a good cause. My dad was a World War II veteran. He tells tales of bureaucratic bungling and you know, subterfuge and lying. It goes on in what we would call good wars as well. But when you have on top of it that you're in there for reason that you just don't understand, the cynicism is hard to fight down.
There's cynicism, but there's also eyes wide open. And John, do you think soldiers going in today have a better sense of what they're in for because of your generation?
Surely, than our parents did. You know, when everything was wonderful, coming off of World War II, Jane. I would say that Carl and I were talking about the show, before the show, about the importance of calling things as they are. I'm glad Laura just having this conference dedicated to the cost. There is a considerable, when you go to war, there is a cost. And what is the cost? And particularly on the individual level, we're looking at soldiers that in retrospect to their service are kind of waking up to the fact that they went in wanting to be soldiers of the realm. And if they're not careful, they could be starting to see themselves as pawns of a system they don't believe in, that carried out missions and strategies that they find not credible in retrospect. And that's a hard thing to discover. However, in talking to many soldiers after their deployments, I've found that telling this truth about how you really feel about it is extremely the number one most freeing thing. And I'm, of course, glad. I hope we will get into the fact that how things are much different today around soldiers seeking out opportunities to talk about these things in various forums, particularly at the vet centers and the VA.
Well, and if there are soldiers listening and you'd like to share your experience, what you've learned, what you think the cost of war is, or maybe from a family perspective, a community perspective, you can share your thoughts with us on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. You can also call in with a question for Carl Marlantis or John Coffin. Again, 1-800-639-2211. John, you mentioned that you think it's important at a military academy to be talking about these issues. And Carl, I understand you spoke this morning for the symposium. What's it like to talk about the cost of war to current students and faculty at a military academy?
Well, it's one of the reasons I wrote my second book. I'm not a pacifist. I'm a Marine. I think if someone threatens our lives and our ways of our values, and the ultimate answer is having to fight, then I'm in. But I don't want any romantics in there. And I think that we tend to still today romanticize it. It's like, well, you can get trained for a new kind of job. I call it the all-recruited military more than the all-volunteer military. I mean, you know, there's sort of ways of soft-pedaling it. And I was at the Air Force Academy, and I was talking to the general that is in charge of their curriculum. And she said to me, you know, we never use the word killing here. I said, well, that's not good. The Air Force is probably the most destructive killers that we unleash on the world. And so you need to understand that the mission isn't to kill people, but in the course of getting your mission done, you will end up taking human life. And you better be prepared, and I think ahead of time before you get involved and understand about it. You just need to be more responsible, grow up more than – it's not like saying I'm going to be a dentist or I'm going to work for Microsoft. This is not business. This is not a career. This is more like a calling, and it's serious.
And do you see that reflected in the eyes of the students when you talk? Do you see an understanding of that and a sense of that calling?
I do, actually. And it's, you know, bell-shaped curves. There's a few lunkheads that probably, you know, are wishing they weren't there. But most of them are I think they are dead serious about it because they, you know, like especially at Norwich, I mean, that's their money and they're on their own ticket and they're serious about it. So I think they do take it serious. On the other hand, you gotta remember they're 18 to 22 years old. And, you know, when I was 18 to 22, someone could tell me something serious and I'd nod my head and go, yeah, that's right. And then I would forget about it about 2 seconds later. But that's not somebody's fault. That's an age-appropriate thing. And quite frankly, I would never want to go to war with anything but an 18 to 22-year-old because, you know, once they get older than that, it's like, well, I don't know if we should take the hill. Where's the Air Force? We should bomb them. You know, I mean, these kids, they'll do what they're told, and they do it with a great deal of enthusiasm. So you have a bind here. I mean, the very thing that makes them great warriors, which is lack of introspection, is one of the things that you need to inculcate in them so that they come out less damaged when things go badly or when they really do realize that they're taking human life.
John,
yeah,
pick
I'll talk
up on
about,
that. Yeah.
I'll talk about going into a class, Jane. That's a great question. I was concerned. I kind of popped into a second year Reserve Officer Training Corps class, and I was surprised to find that they were talking about resiliency during combat at the in the class. Subject, how to remain psychologically and spiritually adaptable in the midst of chaos. And that was pretty sophisticated treatment taught by a senior non-commissioned officer, Army, three tours, someone who knew, was a credible witness on the subject. And what I was able to pick up on is a little speech I tried to give people about, well, for example, when I came into the service, we didn't have any choice back in the Vietnam. It was either become a private, get drafted and become a private, or go to ROTC and become a lieutenant. But one way or another, you're going to Vietnam, unless you were very fortunate. I didn't know. I had a set of fantasies and saw myself as a man who wanted to lead men in battle based on some kind of maybe family of origin concerns and a mythological view of my, wannabe mythological view of myself. About halfway through my college education, I realized that this fantasy was not going to, this war in Vietnam was a mess, and I didn't want to lead men in battle. I had thought that because I was a football player and could lead men on the football field, that would translate into the battlefield. But there was a little matter of integrity and the morals of the war which got in the way of that. So what I want to suggest to people today, and what I was glad to have an opportunity at Norwich to discuss, is who are you and what are you doing in this class in a uniform? Kind of a know thyself exercise. I'm hoping that people will take a better look than I did at what they're doing there. And as Carl says, our job is to defend ourselves from either harm or our system being compromised by those from without. And our job will be to kill people and keep them from killing us. And that's pretty harsh. However, that's what it comes down to. And if we know that going in, knowledge is power. Knowledge, we have an ability to look at that and see that dilemma that poses for us, not only while we're in the service, but afterward. And then, of course, in my view, if we can, everything turns on developing some kind of a spiritual condition. Carl likes to refer to the divine, something about the realm of the divine that we place ourselves in, instead of just, if you have to just rely on yourself and your own ability to psychologically work out the impact of the war on yourself, I think you're in trouble. But once you start looking bigger than yourself.
Well, if I can just jump in, what it is that if you're asking a 19 or 20-year-old to take the role of God, who gives life and takes life? What's the appropriate role? It's the deity. It's not some teenager. But our country asks teenagers to step into that role. When you're dealing with death, you're dealing with spirituality and religion. That's what it's all about. I mean, I don't think we would have very many churches if we weren't afraid of dying. I mean, I'm sorry to be a little cynical, but it's just the way it works. And so when you're dealing with death, you've got to accept you're dealing in the spiritual realm. And people don't like to think about war. We love to think about Christmas. We never like to think about Good Friday, all right? You know, I mean, it's just like we love pixie dust. We don't want to have serious issues like death, you know. So war is and has a spiritual side. And in my second book, I explore that a little bit, that we just want to sort of just scatter under the rug. And I think it's important. A lot of what people deal with post-traumatic stress is what they call a moral wound or what's it called? Anyway, it's not just psychological. It's that you have been put into a position where you actually go against everything that you've been told since you were age zero. Now how do you deal with it? And I think that without talking and bringing to consciousness, there is a spiritual side to it. We do our young people a disservice.
But would anybody go if they knew and thought about all those things that you're talking about? Would you have gone if you knew that you were going to be living with PTSD for the rest of your life? Or John, if you knew that this was going to change the whole shape of your career and your life, would either of you have gone? Would we have soldiers if they were able, all of them, to think the way you are asking them to think before they leave?
I might well have gone, Jane, because I would have had the experience within myself that I wasn't conscious enough at the time and didn't have myself of making a free choice. I mean, there are legitimate conditions under which we need to defend ourselves and project ourselves into the world. The problem is that Soldiers I've talked to coming back after 3 to 7 years begin to wonder what it was that they did, having been somewhat unaware of what they were going to do before they went in. To wit, I've been projected out there by statesmen that have likely had no military experience, nor have their children had any military experience. And I've been placed on the ground in some foreign land to provide a service to the country, theoretically. But I'm beginning to question that now. Now, if I had known going in that I was most likely to be projected into a very compromised, questionable situation, I could have asked myself, is that okay for you to go into that and be a warrior in that realm, or is it not? Or am I the kind of person who's going to have a lot of trouble with that? And in my own case, I'm not the ideal warrior. I'm a very sensitive, intuitive, feeling-oriented cream puff of a guy who looks good. But if I had really been able to ask myself a hard question about, am I the kind of guy who can tolerate being a trained killer for the United States, the answer would have been no. But I didn't have that chance in those days. So we're glad to have these, as Carl says, we're glad to have these chances to face the reality and the brutality of the situation up front now.
I have a little different take. I would have gone, absolutely, because it's in my biology. I think young men are – it's just ingrained to just protect their people. They'll throw themselves in front of their women to take the bullet. That's just instinctual. The issue is that the statesmen, the adults in the society have to line up that very noble instinct with noble ends. And so if there in fact is a situation where it's quite clear – that if I don't go and I don't act and take on this stuff of maybe coming back wounded or without a leg or disabled with post-traumatic stress, if I don't take those chances, then my loved ones will suffer. I will do it. And I think that that will never go away. I think that that's something that our species has. And our problem is lining it up so that our instincts to protect are really lined up with, in fact, what the situation politically is. Is it a protection situation or is it something else? And I think that's the issue.
I mean, it's a big concern that if I'm being sent for self-serving political reasons, that's not okay with me. I have a little proposal, and that's that each state elect a veteran to be on a National Vets Council that gets the last check off on the president or Congress's bright idea to, quote, put boots on the ground, which most of them don't even know what that means. But I would like to see this committee of 52 individuals have the final check off on whether the nation really sends somebody out to kill people.
It's an interesting concept. I wonder if anybody would go for that. We're talking today about what it's like to go to war and then come home and how the echoes of war ripple through communities. Listeners, we will take your calls and emails coming up. And if you have a question for our guests, John Coffin and Carl Marlantis, you can call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we are talking with writer and former Marine Lieutenant Carl Marlantis and retired Army Colonel and psychologist John Coffin, who spent decades with the Vermont National Guard. They're both speakers at this year's annual Colby Military Writers Symposium at Norwich University. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this year's theme, how war affects families, communities, and the nation, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Luke, who's calling in from Richmond. Hi, Luke. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I had to pull off the highway because I just finished Matterhorn last night, and I can almost not speak because of the way it was written and the actual what appeared in my mind as I was reading. It was so vivid. And I would like to thank Mr. Melandy so much for writing that book and unfortunately for going to Vietnam. I volunteered. I was lucky I didn't get picked. But how somebody could go through all that destruction and losing the friends and the turmoil and want to stay alive after that is beyond me. It's a very sad, true, and angering book, and I just want you to know I appreciate both of you gentlemen for your service, and especially the way you're talking about it right now. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Luke, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate that. We're going to take one more here from Sean in Middlesex. Hi, Sean.
Yes, John and Carl, it's a fascinating and obviously very important discussion, and first and foremost, thanks for your service. I wasn't in the service, but I've got family members who were, a grandfather that was in the Battle Bulge, actually ended up liberating concentration camps, liberated Paris, and a cousin who was killed in Vietnam. And my question for you folks is, you know, how do we balance protecting our interests domestically and avoiding these ongoing conflicts, you know, major conflicts every 15 to 20 years?
Sean, thanks for the call. Carl, do you want to start?
Well, first of all, I think that we need to take some action as citizens and elect people to Congress and then make sure that they understand what their constitutional role is. It's sort of along the lines of what John's suggesting, but the founding fathers already figured that out. Congress hasn't declared war since, you know, start of World War II. That's a long time to dereliction of duty. So the first thing is that the pressure's got to be put on people in Congress to take back their role. I think that's a serious part. And I think that the other thing is quite frankly, just more education, education about the costs of things. I would do things that have to get the people involved in war. For example, if every April 15th, which is coming up, there was a line item that said, here's your taxes. Oh, and here's the war tax that you're paying. I mean, I think it's estimated $5 to $7 trillion have been spent on our last 14 years of war. That's like, if you, what is it, 1,000 billion? So to take 7,000 towns in America and give them each $1 billion. I mean, if you just at least had a sense of what you're paying for it. And I think the other thing is, I think that we need to be able to have forums that where people listen and talk. I mean, veterans should be able to, you know, once a month go to the city hall or I don't care where and just have people show up and listen. And so all of these things that are quite easy. Ceremonies. We have no ceremonies that say that the war is over. I mean, where is the ringing of the church bells or whatever it is that we could do that says now life is different. We're no longer at war, but we're sort of perpetually at it, and it's becoming business as usual, which is a very serious issue. And so there's several things like that.
John?
It's my understanding from soldiers that there's a consciousness changing about the credibility of the people in our system that projects us into war and projects soldiers as individuals onto the battlefield. I have another little bright idea on this, which is that what I would love to see is that officers in training, young officers, and NCOs who will become senior NCOs have an expectation and a career projection of an initial period as a soldier, but the expectation and the planning for themselves becoming serving in public office, where that would be the role of a warrior, of a soldier of the realm, to serve and then go into public office. There's a lot of Carl actually got me reading about the ancients on this, and in fact. In the old days in Greece, they used to have to go to the tragedies every year. All of the citizens, granted that only 1 out of 10 persons in the arena was a citizen, but all the citizens had to go and watch the tragedies. And of course, 60% of the citizens in those days were soldiers. So you have this major interface facing the horrors of war, and there were considerably in those days, together. We don't have that. What dialogue is there between veterans and our political system? Limited. Vermont did a good job with this on some levels, not at the highest levels of administration and the government. You know, there were spots of brilliance, but I think Vermont, let me just say it, I think ranks third to the bottom in benefits to veterans. And somehow it's out of sight, out of mind. This is the kind of thing a veteran can get hooked on in terms of having a resentment about the government. But I would call on veterans to get themselves into politics, to have a voice.
John, you worked with many Vermont soldiers and soldiers from other parts of the country who had been deployed. You were often the first real official they interacted with when they stepped off the plane at Camp Shelby or wherever they came back to the U.S. You debriefed them. We've talked with you a lot about that over the years and your role in connecting with soldiers as they were coming off the battlefield, as they were ending their deployment. How are Vermont soldiers who were deployed 10 years ago doing now, John?
I'm not comfortable unequivocally commenting on the state of soldiers. I can tell you something we probably already talked about, which is the difference between how soldiers are doing or have the opportunity to do right now, if they will seek it, of today versus when Carl and I came back from Southeast Asia. I mean, there are resources, there are all kinds of activities going on that soldiers can get into, and there are counseling forums for soldiers to get into, and many, many soldiers have availed themselves to this, to their enormous credit, and to the society, to our credit on the civilian side, on the good news side, is we have provided these opportunities. I mean, imagine if I called the Vet Center over in Colchester in South Burlington today. I bet I could get in there in a day. And, you know, it's very different than other parts of the country. But I think soldiers are – I would love to see every soldier go for at least four sessions and find something to talk about sitting in front of a counselor who knows what's going on talking to a veteran. I would love to see that because I've never met a vet who regretted going in just to touch down. So I'm optimistic. But there are a lot of people out there hiding in the swamp, figuratively speaking, that aren't coming in. And we've made some good efforts to outreach to them. The Guard has had a good – we started with a door knocker policy maybe 10 years ago, and now there's a lot of outreach. So I'm optimistic but concerned.
Let's hear from Joanna in Charlotte. Hi, Joanna. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say thank you for your service. I appreciate everyone who serves in the military. One of my brothers was killed in Vietnam, and I'd like to bring up the point that PTSD is not just about the soldier. My family and my brother's wife were a wreck for years after he was killed. I would like to propose that there be a Department of Peace, whatever you want to call it, that be part of a counterpart to the Department of Defense to fully vet any of these decisions that are made about going to war, to do the research, to take the time to really analyze the reasons for going. And I feel like we'd have a better chance of making better decisions instead of always being on the defensive. And I'd also like to say that I understand your point about spirituality, but I do feel like religion is used a lot of time to brainwash people into accepting war as the answer. So those are my comments, and thank you very much.
Joanna, thanks for your call. Good. Carl Marlantis, what are you thinking?
Well, I was thinking that people are coming up with ideas like Joanna just had one. I mean, I think one of the more fundamental ones, which we sort of dodge all the time, is the all-volunteer military. The sons and daughters of the people making the decisions aren't at stake. And, I mean, it's less than 0.5% of the country is involved. And I think over half the military comes from 7 southern states. It's very, very narrow. And the elites have basically dropped out. This is not healthy for a republic. And unless the decision makers have something at stake, like their own family, they're going to think differently. I mean, if I've got a Praetorian guard that'll just do what I say, and I'm the president and I can commit them without even the Congress saying, it's way easier. So I think that we have to really re-examine the draft. And I would say we should have like a national service. I mean, we can't take everybody into the military, and I wouldn't want everybody in the military. I mean, there are several of my kids that I wouldn't want in the military, but out of that national service, if you have to do 2 years, you're going to start getting people from places like Yale and Harvard and Pomona saying, well, I guess I might as well do my 2 years in the military. And you'll start moving it back because the sons and daughters of the elites are the ones that go to the elite schools. And maybe you'd start to see a little more ownership of the decisions to go to war. And the second one that I really think is important is that we've got to get it conscious that I use the analogy that there's a rifle, and the rifle is paid for by everybody who pays taxes. It is. I mean, whether you agree with the war or disagree with it, you're involved. And there are teachers that teach the scientists that design the rifles and farmers that grow the food, that feed the factory workers that build the rifle. But at the end of all that chain, that big chain of being, at the end of it, some 19-year-old pulls the trigger. But what we say as a nation is he did the killing. And as soon as that's done, as soon as that attitude is out there that he did the killing, not us, you have an alienation. And it's very hard to break that alienation down. We did the killing. We have to learn to own it. If we're at war, we are involved, whether we agree with the war or not. Your shoes are you've stepped in it, and you've got to just own it. And I think that our country's very good at sort of, you know, as one president said, go shopping. Oh, great. Let's go shopping. Let's not own what we're doing. We are at war.
We're talking today with Carl Marlantis and John Coffin. We're talking about the cost of war. They're going to stay with us here for the rest of the hour. And you are welcome to share your thoughts as well. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today about the cost of war with two speakers at the Colby Military Writers Symposium at Norwich University going on this week. Carl Marlantis is a former Marine lieutenant who served in the combat infantry in Vietnam. His two books are Matterhorn and What It Is Like to Go to War. John Coffin retired as a colonel from the U.S. Army in 2013. He has 49 years of service, served as a lieutenant in Southeast Asia in 1968 to 1970, and he spent a long time as the staff psychologist with the Vermont National Guard. We're also taking your thoughts, your comments, your questions on the cost of war at vpr.net. You can click on Vermont Edition and carry on the conversation there, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Rob in Burlington. Hi, Rob. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And it's refreshing to hear that two men like this who've served our country and been in the military have sort of come around 180 degrees and now seriously questioning whether or not it was in the best interest of our country to go to this war. And what I sort of would like to find out is, at the time of that war, all the people who opposed it and actually saw that it wasn't in the best interest of the country to go to the war have been ostracized, basically, for all these years, and yet all the people who serve in the military are glorified, and they still continue on that course. So that's my question.
Rob, thanks for the call. Carl, John, what do you think?
Well, I assume he's talking about the Vietnam War.
Yeah, that's my assumption too.
Yeah. I think that it's a fair point. I mean, this is a democracy, and we need to have people who express their opinions. And if their opinion is that this is a dumb war, then that needs to be expressed. I remember when I was over there going like, yeah, guys, yeah, tell them, you know. And I think that what happened, though, is that the shameful way that the veterans were treated, when the actual combat veterans, when they came back, the country is now kind of embarrassed about that. I mean, we were treated shamefully. And now that it's almost gone the other way. It's like everybody's a hero. I mean, if you're a supply clerk on a ship and nowhere near combat, you come home, and I think our current military people are embarrassed by some of this stuff. It's like, you're a hero. Not a hero. I did my job. I signed up. And so I think it's a pendulum issue that when we came back, we were vilified. Now it's like all military is great. And I think it's like, let's get some perspective here. Let's bring it into some kind of perspective. And I think that the reason that we fight wars, one of the biggest reasons is that we want to have the freedom of speech. It's in our Constitution. And people need to just accept that this country of 300 million is not going to have everybody agreeing on things. And that's the messy, wonderful part about it. And I just think that, people need to stick to their guns. That if they want to protest, they got to understand they're not going to make people over there feel good. I mean, it's going to help the enemy. I mean, if the enemy knows that there's a big dissent going on, which happened in North Vietnam, they said, let's just wait a few years. It's going to fall apart. So it prolongs the wars in some ways. But that doesn't mean you stop. You just have to accept that, okay, I'm involved too. There is a war going on. And what I'm going to do to try and stop it is going to make some kids over there feel discouraged because people back home aren't saying, go get them, Tiger, rah, rah. They're saying you shouldn't be there. That's discouraging. And it's encouraging to the enemy. I mean, that is just accept it. It's part of the sticky, horrible thing that we've gotten ourselves into. But the side that says, oh, it's a dumb idea needs to be heard. And I think needs to be listened to. And I think it's this pendulum that we've got now that from shameful treatment of veterans to just almost, you know, glorification, which I think most of my friends who are in, they're just a little embarrassed sometimes about it.
John, why do you think so many people, particularly men of your generation, still feel such a preoccupation with the Vietnam War, whether they served or not? It's such a personal preoccupation of so many, as I said, particularly men of a certain age. Why do you think that is, that it's so deeply ingrained?
That's exactly right, Jane. I'm not sure I know why. I do know that I would concur that that's what's going on. I have a friend whose father was in the military who weekly, despite the fact that I've told him not to do it, apologizes to me for the fact that he didn't serve in combat and wants to talk about the fact that if only, and I'm glad, I appreciated our last caller who asked for the respect of those, as Carl just said, who had all opinions during the Vietnam conflict. I think that we have to encourage that, the naysayers, the yay-sayers, and really hear it. We haven't. I have made an effort to move on. I credit all the people who, I'm just glad everyone's alive who's still alive from the Vietnam era. That includes conscientious objectors, naysayers, the 800 guys who threw their medals away down in Washington. Without them, we might still be over there. That stuff all has to happen. But what I would like to focus on now is, if we're going to send people into combat, I would call on individuals enlisting and the services to do a better job screening individuals for specific jobs. In my observation, a lot of the folks we have sent into combat have no business going to combat. They're like me. They're sensitive, extroverted, intuitive folks that when you put them into a squeeze, they're not going to be pretty in the long run. I would love to have been in the military, and I would love everyone to be in the military, and I think they would do well to serve. But I think I would have been better off as a medical services officer than a rifle carrier. And I think we really do people a disservice. Anybody who wants to get in and carry a rifle and go into battle can get a contract signed to go in, and that. Some of those folks, I think we need to take into basic training and have senior NCOs look at them and take a look at whether this is really going to work out now and not worry about numbers into combat units, but just get people who are really mythologically warriors at heart, and there aren't many, into the warrior roles and everyone else into the support roles so that we don't come back and have people dependent on the VA system for the rest of their lives who've been emotionally and psychologically and spiritually destroyed by their combat experience when they shouldn't have been in there in the first place.
That's John Coffin. He retired as a colonel from the U.S. Army in 2013. He served in Southeast Asia, 1968 to 1970, was for many years the staff psychologist with the Vermont National Guard, debriefing soldiers as they returned home from deployments. We've also been talking with Carl Marlantis, a former Marine lieutenant who served in the combat infantry in Vietnam. He's the author of two books, Matterhorn, a novel about the Vietnam War, and the nonfiction book, What It Is Like to Go to War. They're both speakers this week at Norwich University. Thank you so much, both of you, for being on the program again.
Thank you, Jane.
Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll learn about the important architectural styles and the architects associated with the many Vermont churches that dot the landscape. And we'll hear about efforts to preserve these sometimes very old buildings. You can send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen to the show tomorrow live at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.